You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, which is professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for November 1st, 2013. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from the midnight showing of Conservatism, Days of Future Past, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal. Hey, Blue Gal.
Hey.
Yeah, the X-Men movie's coming out, which I will absolutely not see.
You'll wait till it's on non-pay TV.
I will. And some child demands that we go see it, and yeah. I'll give in.
Put it on.
But as we stand outside of the political universe and watch it go round and round and always come up on the same two or three outcomes, it is difficult for me to have a lot of hope that one of our two major political parties will recover its sanity anytime soon, because their entire internal dynamic is built on a basically flawed and despicable premise that they can't fix without sort of tearing the whole thing apart and starting over again.
Well, and it bothers me a lot that we're so quickly getting back to both sides.
Oh, one day. It was one day.
It really was.
It was after, though, we avoided a government shutdown, and we didn't avoid a government shutdown. The government's open again. We're not going to crash the world economy. Hey, let's get back to talking about both sides.
Yeah. And which, the extremists on both sides.
Which, remarkably, I predicted with 100% accuracy.
You did.
And because after every one of these fake crises, I predict the exact same thing, and I'm right every time. Mm-hmm. And that's what's starting to get annoying, is watching, as we mentioned in the last show, watching the conservatives who end up on the outside looking in at the end of each crisis, turning around and saying, well, you know, if only they'd listened to me 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, this could have all been avoided. No, it could have been avoided if you had listened to liberals 20 or 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. But you're part of the problem. And now you want to play wise man that you saw this coming. Well, you know, sorry. Fuck you. Fuck you, Michael Steele. You know, I tell you what. You want to earn some cred? Go put a burning bag of dog shit on Phyllis Schlafly's porch. Halloween. Then come back to me and talk to me about how you're a badass. But
because the Statue of Liberty has nothing to do with immigration.
No.
Says Phyllis Schlafly.
Says Phyllis.
I blame hardening of the arteries. I really do. I feel sad.
Well,
she was crazy 30 years ago, too. But
Phyllis Schlafly is the godmother of the conservative movement.
She is. Yeah.
She is the, you know, if Reagan is the daddy, she's the mommy. And every one of these bastard children that they produced, they're now running around this country, tearing everything down and pissing on it. Is a product of that unholy union, and there were other people involved, mind you. This was not a two-person project. Decades ago.
Mm-hmm.
This is simply the fruit of that which was planted decades ago. And the entire political media system is devoted to pretending that that's not true. Because, as I've said, I know ad nauseum, the moral obligation, the moral fallout that you would have if you had to admit that one of our two major political parties is just evil.
Mm-hmm.
And people who you know who support them uncritically are crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Selfish.
And there's all kinds of other negative emotions that dominate in that party. Yeah.
If that became our media story, which it should be, I mean, let's face it, this conservative media has hit. It has struck. It has wrecked things. It is continuing to wreck things. And the entire think about the awesomeness of this tremendous, disastrous, ongoing train wreck of a story about one of our two major political parties being utterly depraved and destructive, and the entire political media burning the candle at both ends, expending every effort not to report that story.
Well, there's two things that came up this week that feed into this both sides thing.
Yeah.
One is a Republican congressman, Jeff Denham, who was on Chris Hayes this week. And you and I just put our heads in our hands as he was talking. He, I hate to say this, Driftglass, but he's one of the good ones when it comes to immigration.
One of the three good ones.
Yeah. He's five good ones. Willing and wanting to vote on the Senate immigration reform bill.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Not block it, not spend 6 months pretending that we're coming up with our own bill, mm-hmm. which they should have done 2 years ago, at least. But saying, no, let's vote on the Senate bill. Let's bring the Senate bill to the House. All of the Democrats will vote for it. We think we can get 25 Republicans to vote for it.
Well, let me just put your math there, because Chris Hayes did have the number.
He did.
Yesterday. It was 185 Democrats and two Republicans.
Oh, my gosh.
So
now, and he, but Chris Hayes brought up those numbers at the very end of the interview.
He did. He did.
In response to Jeff Denham saying, because mm-hmm. at first his points were, no, I think we need to convince our fellow Republicans in the House to mm-hmm. vote for the Senate bill before Christmas. Let's get this done. Mm-hmm. Let's just do it. It'll help our party. It'll help America. It's a good bill. Let's do it.
And then Chris Hayes, to his credit, asked, but yeah. what happens?
What happens?
The Republican Party kills this yeah. on purpose, kills it. This last best chance for reform. What happens then?
What happens to your party then? I think yes. was his question.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
what are the consequences if, as I really feel, mm-hmm. if this dies, it's your party's fault
and
that
what
this
did
happened.
Congressman Denham say? Would you like me to quote him directly?
Yes, that would be wonderful.
Congressman Denham, well, certainly over the last decade or so, you can blame both parties. Both parties may have made mistakes. The president certainly had control of both houses in the presidency and could have gotten this through. And then he goes on and says, blah, blah, blah. It's pretty much put up or shut up. Now it's time for the House to act. And he ends with, I think what really causes challenges in the election are these extremes that say outrageous things, continue to label the brand of my party, or the outrageous things that have been said on the other side of the aisle as well. At which point, Chris Hayes manfully did yep. not stick a pen in this guy's throat.
A shiv in this guy's neck.
And throw him out of the fucking window. And really. But he did say,
that's when he said, for the record,
yeah.
it's 158 Democrats.
185.
And 85 Democrats and two Republicans. Thank you for your time.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And I thought, well, okay. So we're back. Now we're back from outer space.
But let's be clear that this is a Republican congressman who... all of them,
right.
to a man, and it's usually men, mm-hmm. when they're backed up and against a corner, the only shield they have is both sides.
Right. And not now just congressmen.
We saw that with Marco
Rubio
on The Daily Show.
On The Daily Show. It was
constant. Both sides of the aisle.
It was comical because John Stewart kept asking him really pointed questions about his party. And all he responded to was, well, you know, both sides. Well, the extremes on both sides. You know, both sides do it. This morning. I'm recording this on Halloween
morning.
Well,
this is what I want to change to, because this is different. What you're about to talk about with Chuck Todd, I'm reading your notes, Driftwood.
Chuckles McTodd. Oh, well, all Chuckles McTodd did was put on two pollsters mm-hmm. who were identically dressed, one Republican, one Democrat. But can you tell them apart? I don't think so. And it was a word cloud. The mm-hmm. word cloud was, in both sides, both parties think that what we need is more compromise and cooperation.
And out there in the field.
Out there in the world.
Yeah.
The biggest words that pop out of this word cloud are cooperation, compromise, etc. And the conclusion, of course, that he drew and that his pollsters drew was, you know, maybe if just politicians in both parties would listen to these people and stop being so intractable and extreme. It's both sides. And he wouldn't fucking shut up about it.
And that's the Washington media pushing for a grand bargain on Social Security.
That is the
liberal nobody media. Out in the field wants.
That is the liberal MSNBC pushing that. That is Chuck Todd, MSNBC employee, going on liberal television explaining that 50% of the problem is Republicans.
So Chuck Todd, uh-huh. I forgive the media for being forced to report on the party that actually currently holds the House.
Yes.
And the stupid things they say.
Yes.
And I would like them at some point to string together all of the times that these Congress people, elected officials, I hold elected officials to a different standard.
Yes.
This is the problem with both sides is, so you have Louie Gohmert on the right, but then you have Michael Moore on the left.
Yeah. Senator Michael Moore said what?
Congressman Michael Moore? President yeah. Michael Moore said what? Louie Gohmert is an elected official from the state mm-hmm. of Texas. Rand Paul is an elected official. I hold those people to, you know, Ted Cruz, to a standard.
Yes.
Of they need to tell the truth. They need to not hide behind both sides. And when the media reports what they say, mm-hmm. They're elected officials. There is some gravitas in what they are actually saying because they've been elected to represent people.
You know who disagrees with you? Who? John Stewart.
John Stewart.
And, because I've observed he has a different standard.
What's his?
He expects politicians to lie.
Yep.
But he gets really angry when journalists lie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what Chuck Todd is doing is lying.
Yep.
What Joe Scarborough is doing is lying.
What Chuck Todd is doing is more pernicious because he has a responsibility, which he denies that he has the responsibility to report on truth. But he has been hired
to lie.
To lie.
To lie. He's been hired. David Gregory is paid to lie to people. He's paid to structure a debate in such a way that nothing truthful gets said. And there is no one above him to hold him accountable. There's no elected official. There's only the marketplace. And the marketplace for telling people who are too politically cowardly to either admit that their party is the problem or
that any party is the problem. You know, I think that's the problem with these pollsters is they're talking to people who don't think about politics, who don't watch 4 hours of MSNBC every night, who barely watch Fox, who are much more interested in Game 7 than they are in anything else this week.
There is no Game 7, honey.
Oh, did
over
Boston
in six.
Win?
Boston won over in six.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. See, that tells you how much I know.
Breaking sports news.
But they're much more interested in the World Series than they are. And there's nothing wrong with that if that's where you are. But then you get the phone call saying, what do you think about politics?
Oh, everybody's just so
sick of it. They're just all fighting all the time. I want both sides to just get along because I'm busy watching sports. And if they break in to talk about some election thing, it interrupts me.
It's confusing to me.
And that becomes the news when the pollsters dress alike and go on Chuck Todd's show. Oh, you know, the problem is both sides. It totally feeds into the story they want to report.
And that's the thing that one must realize from watching television commercials being produced or watching the continuity person make sure the ash is just as long in this shot as it was in that. Is that very little happens on television by accident. Newt Gingrich doesn't get invited on Meet the Press by accident. He doesn't just show up.
Show on CNN.
He gets his own show because the marketing people who market the news know exactly who they want to sell to and exactly what those people want to hear. They want to hear this big city on the edge of the ocean called Washington is messed up. And they're smart hayseeds who know better. If only they could send people there with common sense, they'd fix that mess up right quick. You know they would. That's what their audience wants to hear. And that is the product that David Gregory and David Brooks and Chuck Todd and all the rest of them sell to them. The problem is, it's a lie. And everyone involved knows it's a lie.
Yeah.
And
it's not only a lie, though, Driftglass. They also focus on their own soap opera dramas. I'm thinking particularly of the all-morning coverage of the Sebelius hearings.
Yeah.
As if that was going to lead to any resolution of anything.
Yeah.
And ignoring for 3 or 4 hours of news time the hunger cliff that we're hitting tomorrow. Yes.
Tomorrow. Food stamps get cut by billions of dollars tomorrow, regardless of what happens.
Yeah.
The choice is now between a $5 billion cut and a $40 billion cut. But food for hungry children gets cut. Well, in fact, as of this podcast, as of today.
And they're so fucking lazy, too, that this is the thing that really bothers me is they, because they're in New York City and it's obviously easy to find food stamp recipients in New York City. I'm not being anti-New York City in the regard of actual citizens needing help in the city.
No.
But it's easy for a camera crew to go out and go to a bread line or go to a food bank line and interview everyone. And because it's New York City, they are all going to be women of color with preschool children waiting in line for food.
Mm-hmm.
And that reinforces the Republican narrative completely that this is poor, lazy black women who don't know how to use birth control.
Right.
And so we can punish them for their sexuality,
for their immorality,
for their immorality, for their irresponsibility, for their laziness, for the, whatever. It totally, even though they're covering the story of these are hungry people who are going to lose benefits, by doing that, they're reinforcing the Republican narrative.
Well, And again, the entire apparatus of our media is engineered to protect people from things that make them uncomfortable.
Right, right.
Horror is great. Horror movies are fine because those are scary. You can turn those off. But if the story of America is the richest country on earth, the most bountiful country, because we're still a debtor nation. We don't have to be. We used to be a creditor nation before Ronald Reagan took over. But the most bountiful country in the world has 15% of its people in poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Has 40-odd million Americans.
22-23% of their children in poverty.
And hungry, going hungry, people going hungry in this country, which is something that conservatives do not believe. They refuse to believe that that's true. Because the moral imperative that would be imposed on them, their Bible would literally leap from their bedside and start smacking them upside the head if they had to admit that the most bountiful country on earth that has produced more billionaires, more phenomenally rich people than any country in history, lets that many people starve in its streets every night, is such an offense against God or against our common humanity, depending on which church you go to, that we would be morally obliged to do something about it. Yep. Therefore, we must invent a fiction that pretends it isn't true, that those people are all cheaters and liars and thieves and welfare queens, and she has 11 names and 9 Cadillacs, and they're all ripping you off, man. All those lazy Negroes are ripping you off because you're a hardworking person, and they're not, and they're taking your stuff. That's the narrative.
What I think the narrative has changed since 2008, because a lot of white working people like me went on food stamps in 2008 and know what that program is like and know what the bureaucracy is like and know about having to confirm your income every 6 months, knowing what it's like to go to the food stamp office and meet with your caseworker
with a folder full of documents.
Proving that you're making this much money. You have this. You have to show them your bank statements. You have to show them your pay stubs.
Oh,
you have all of it.
And
I
just slightly above that in the economic ladder. I have been on unemployment a few times.
When we got married.
Since I lost my last full-time job, I've been on and off. I'm not on now. I have a small part-time job that it pays about as much as a paper route, but it's slightly better than unemployment. And I'm working. And working makes me feel great.
Yeah. And it looks good on your resume that you're working. Yeah.
And working, it reinforces so many different noble impulses, I would say about my value to society.
Yeah.
Even though it is less than a paper route.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're on unemployment, the maximum benefit you can get in the state of Illinois, no matter what you are making, is $400 and something a week.
Yep.
Give or take. And you have to apply for work every week. Mm-hmm. And you have to call and confirm that you've done that. And you have to meet with your case manager and demonstrate documentation of the people you've called, what they said, whether or not you got work. You have to confirm every week that you're still fit for work. Mm-hmm. There's an entire process you have to go through. And you can cheat it. And then you get caught. And then you never have unemployment again. And they can fine you. And they can make your life miserable.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the fantasy that doing this just to keep a roof over your head, just to keep food on your plate while you're trying to improve your life is somehow a hammock in which we repose because poor people are lazy. They don't want to get off their asses. They don't want to get any better.
And we don't want to make them dependent on this so that they never get off their asses. The fact is people are kicked off of food stamps every single day.
Yes.
And they're kicked off because their income goes up. And that's what happened to us. I've mentioned this before, and I'm sorry to those people who faithfully listen every week. But when I married you, Driftglass, your unemployment check pushed us over the limit for food stamps.
Mm-hmm.
And we lost our food stamps because you had too much money coming in for unemployment.
Yes.
There should be a line that says, you're making over, you're getting $400 a week in unemployment. And you have this other income. There is a point at which we say, okay, you know what? You can afford groceries. And so we're gonna give it to somebody who has less money than you.
Yes.
I understand that.
Absolutely.
And that mechanism works because every 6 months, I mean, and I've said this to you before, if we ever get to the point of having to apply for food stamps again, I'm going to hesitate simply because it is such a chore to have to get all of that paperwork together every 6 months,
mm-hmm.
of proving, and it's an invasion of your privacy to get, and for us, for the three kids and I think we got less than $150 a month for food stamps. And that helped, but I spent that within the first 10 days of the month.
Sure. Liquor and steaks.
No.
On food for children.
On things that would not go bad.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's what you always spend it on. Mm-hmm. Canned goods and starch.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a nutrition program. I'm sorry.
No.
It's ramen noodles, spaghetti, rice,
mm-hmm.
canned beans, things with lots of salt in them, things that will keep, because you never want to throw away food when you're in food
stamps, and
ever.
You and I navigating those programs.
Yeah.
We have a lot of education between us.
We do.
And we have a lot of experience between us. I used to work on the other side of some of these programs.
Of that desk, yeah.
And
yeah.
So I deeply understand.
You weren't a case manager, but you almost were.
No, yeah. I was well up the food chain from case managers.
Yeah.
But I certainly had day-to-day interactions with people. I knew what was going on. You can look at the workforce and labor force numbers. You can look at the unemployment rates. You can watch what's happening in the job market and know sort of, where your chances are best, where they're worst. In my case, my circumstances are such that I'm highly qualified and I'm over 45.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes me virtually unemployable in a lot of places, because I don't want to break this to you, but if you're over a certain age and you've been unemployed for more than a couple of weeks, you're unemployable.
Yeah.
Period. And when the economy gets better, that will change. I'm lucky to have a job. But the point being, that is the reality of being poor. Even temporarily poor, even well prepared and with lots of education poor in America. That reality is so terrifying to conservatives and to the both-siders that they need to construct this fabulous fiction about welfare queens and young bucks eating steaks, and how it's all cheaters and liars and immigrants and dirty Mexicans who are stealing all their money. They need that lie. And they will not give it up. And you can pound them over the head with as much proof and evidence and documents and graphs as you want, and they're never going to fucking believe you, because the alternative is so frightening.
Yeah.
Just as
I like your image of the Bible getting up off their bedside table and smacking them in the middle of the night.
Well, this is where that's a horror story right there. Let me chop. This is where my sort of the drift cloud shrug comes in.
Yeah.
Because it's not that another piece of evidence is going to change their mind.
Well, and this is when the blue gal tear in her eye comes in. And I have been saying to myself for the past 24 hours, despair, not today, not today. I'm not going to despair today. You know, J.P. Morgan Chase, the world's largest bank, agreed to pay $13 billion to settle government lawsuits.
Yes. Cheap.
And they've also reported that they have increased their lobbying efforts in the third quarter from... Second quarter was $1,270,000 on lobbying.
But per month?
Mm-hmm. No, per quarter.
Per quarter, months, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the third quarter, it went up all the way to $1,430,000.
Yeah.
So they spent almost $200,000 more in the third quarter than they did in the second quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not an increase from the $1,270,000, that's in addition to.
Yeah.
They spent another $1.4 million on lobbying.
Yeah, on getting Congress people to walk back all of those rules that mean they have to actually
let us write the regs. Yeah, yeah. I thought it was really funny that Chris Hayes had all those congressmen saying, look, Barney Frank wants this. Barney Frank wants all this language in there. And then my guest tonight is Barney Frank. No, I'm really everybody loves a dead congressman or somebody who's not there anymore because they can't stand up and say, you're lying about my record.
Mm-hmm. Well, that happening at the same. I mean, the idea that their Citibank is harvesting its lobbyists.
Yeah.
It's bribed.
It's congressman. Yeah.
It's congressman now.
Yeah.
At exactly the same moment, to the tune of billions of dollars, at exactly the same moment that we're going to cut food for poor children because we're broke. Is so, again, the telling the story like that as straight news would impose such an unbelievable moral obligation on anybody with a conscience that it would be impossible for anybody with a conscience to go to the polls and vote for Republicans ever again, which is why it's really important to keep intact the
fairy tale. Sides, yes.
Fairy
yes.
tale. And let me spin out slightly. This is in our notes, but it's I want to give credit where credit is due. Mm-hmm. And then talk about how I paid a dear price for giving credit where it was due. Not really. It wasn't that big a price. But it was funny. It cracked me right the hell up. As longtime listeners and readers know, I am occasionally a little hard on Mr. Glenn Greenwald. Mm-hmm. Not because I don't think the story he's reporting is important, because it is important. Not because the NSA doesn't desperately need to be reined in, because it does, or the FISA court is weak. I fault Mr. Greenwald almost exclusively for... A, when he lies, which he does, real easy to prove. You can go to my blog and look it up. He makes shit up to bolster his argument that just isn't true. And then never walks it back, never apologizes, never says he retracts it, never says he went too far. And B, he's a real zealot. And he I think in the post I did, it's, you know, a journalist says something about facts and proof. You know, here's X is true and here's the proof. An advocate says X is true and it's wrong. A zealot says X is true, and if you disagree with me even slightly, you're a drooling servant of fascism. That last category he steps into way too often. Mm-hmm. And for me, as someone who wants to understand the story, it gets really tired really fast of this constant shrill name-calling and slandering of anyone who disagrees with him by him and his followers. Yeah. That said... So that's my long history with Glenn Greenwald.
Well, and his level of influence is so much higher than any and has gotten higher still.
Yes,
and we'll talk about that in a minute. But he is seen by the mainstream media as a journalist rather than as an advocate. Mm-hmm. When you have someone on from Greenpeace to talk about their issue, everyone kind of looks at that with, okay. You know, or Code Pink.
Right.
Code Pink comes on and talks about drones.
They never come on.
Well, they don't. They aren't allowed on.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
They're not allowed on. But when they are on, they're on with Amy Goodman.
Yeah.
And they're put in that little box of this is a hippie. This is a left winger. This is that extreme on the left side that we sometimes need to point to.
Right.
Glenn Greenwald is given a pass in that regard.
Yes.
And you're going to talk about how he's been given an infinitely greater pass by the mainstream media.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
But he's now been, we've now monetized the, you know, what Edward
monetized the secrets. Yeah.
Secrets. They're worth $250 million.
Yeah.
It costs $250 million to buy those secrets. And they're building an institution around him. There's going to be a big new bold media thing. And that's all interesting. I don't know if it'll last. Money tends to last. No Labels is a entirely fraudulent organization run scam, which has endured because people keep pumping money into it.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe in money. But having said that about – I don't want to relitigate anything I've already said about Glenn Greenwald. You want to come yell at me, come to my comment section. It's full of people who want to yell at me about how awful an old bot I am and what a drooling servant of fascism, blah, 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 blah. All right. Great. But this week – again, I got started on this by credit where it's due. Glenn Greenwald, thanks, I believe, to his new level of influence and the amount and the size of his wallet now, which is much bigger than it used to be, got to go back and forth with Bill Keller from the New York Times and got to be, you know, we've spent a chunk of this podcast talking about the lies that media tell us, the conspiracy lies, the patently obvious untruths that media just keeps repeating over and over again because there's nobody inside the perimeter calling them out on it, ever, except for Paul Krugman, but he's a special exception. So we get this, and the biggest, you know, promulgator of the fraud of both sides is David Brooks, prominent New York Times columnist on NPR, on PBS, on the morning shows. He is everywhere, and he is now taking a long, whatever the hell a book leave is, to go do all those other things, but not work for the New York Times for a few months. So, but he's not on unemployment, I understand. He had just not filed for his unemployment claims.
Well, I want all those unemployed people to go get jobs as lobbyists for J.P. Morgan Chase.
Wouldn't that be perfect? Thanks, J.P. Morgan Chase.
Yeah.
Jamie Dimon gave me a panini, and now I'm work for him.
No, I'm off of food stamps because I'm eating Jamie Dimon's panini for a living.
Thank you, Jamie Dimon.
Thank you, Jamie Dimon.
Fuck, Walmart does it. Hey, look at this great insurance I've got from this big sucky company that you think is evil. But anyway, Glenn Greenwald has this email exchange with Bill Keller. And to his credit, he got close enough to Bill Keller to land one on his chin. And Keller had nothing to say.
It was about David Brooks.
It was about David Brooks. And I will give full and unreserved credit to Glenn Greenwald for doing this thing. And Glenn Greenwald has been very good about David Brooks for years. I have quoted him. I have cited him in my blog about his critique of David Brooks. So there's this exchange where they're going back and forth about the new media and the old media and accountability and sets of values and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Glenn Greenwald says that, you know, he's asked about whether or not they're going to have conservatives on this brand new site that's, you know, that they're putting up, this multi-million dollar site that they're going to put up. And they're definitely not going to be ideologically homogenized. They've already been speaking with conservative journalists just like that. Real conservatives, Mr. Greenwald says, not the East Coast rendition of, quote, conservatives such as David Brooks. Boom. Our driving ideology is accountability journalism grounded in rigorous factual accuracy, which, you know, I'll quibble about that later some other day. Bill Keller responds after some blah, blah, blah with, your apparent contempt for David Brooks is revealing. I don't think it's apparent at all. I think it's pretty obvious myself. But presumably what disqualifies him from your category of, quote, real conservatives, unquote, is that he puts reason over passion and sometimes finds a middle ground. As Lenin despised liberals, as the Tea Party loathes moderate Republicans, you seem to reserve your sharpest scorn for moderation, for compromise. Look at today's Washington and tell me how that's working out. Says the absolute bastion of both-sider bullshit in America today, Bill Keller and the New York fucking Times. So Mr. Greenwald comes back and says, my contempt, quote-unquote, for David Brooks is grounded in his years of extreme war cheerleading and veneration of an elite political class that has produced little beyond abject failure and corruption. I don't see anything moderate about him at all.
Amen.
Boom.
Yeah.
And to which Bill Keller had no response at all. And that is almost always the case. Once you find yourself in a room with one of these people and you back them up against the wall, they have nothing to say. They're not going to stop lying. Bill Keller's never going to stop telling the same bullshit. David Brooks is never going to be out of work. David Gregory is never going to be fired. But every now and then, somebody gets close enough to one of the glass jaws to take a swing at it. And Glenn Greenwald deserves credit for being close enough to Bill Keller to land a haymaker right in his fucking jaw. Mm-hmm. And he had nothing to say except pointing out what an abject idiot he is for saying, you know, this is David Brooks. He literally does hold David Brooks out as an example. David Brooks doesn't believe in moderation. David Brooks believes in hiding in a false centrism from the fact that the Republican Party he helped create is a monster.
Yep.
But he can't admit that because the day after he does that, he'd be out of work and couldn't afford his mansion anymore. So David Brooks has to keep explaining why both sides are awful, why we must compromise, usually on Republican terms, always on Republican terms. And he does it by inventing wholly fake liberal positions, wholly fake liberal perspectives, wholly fake liberal objections, and counterposing them to real Republican atrocities and saying, see, both sides. Mm-hmm. That way the poison is at the top level of society, at the middle level of society, and way down below where the average citizen, if you ask them what's wrong, is those goddamn congressmen. Every one of them is fucking poison. Both siderism has poisoned our entire ability to even have a conversation about politics. Because again, once you strip that lie away, the moral imperative that immediately leaps into the foreground is terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
We have to get rid of the Republican Party. You know, that's what it means. That's, we have to destroy it, burn it down, rebuild it from the ground up. And I will say there are people who are trying to do that, but they're doomed to fail. And they're doomed to fail because this is the Ramesh Panurus and Rich Lowrys and Andrew Sullivans who are basically ripping off liberal critiques of conservatism and calling it real conservatism. And the reason it is doomed to fail, all reforms launched by these people are doomed to fail because at its core, conservatism requires a liberal villain.
Mm-hmm.
They
yeah.
have to have a liberal villain. And therefore, no matter what you say, no matter how many pretty words and how many abstract ideological conversations you have about Oatenshot and Burke, mm-hmm. you'll always get down to the fact that you have to have a liberal demon to make conservatism work in America.
And you and I have talked about that before, that if the Republican Party dissolved tomorrow, you and I would have lots to talk about.
Sure.
We would have policy structures to build. We would want to be talking about ways to engineer social engineering on the left, which
global climate change.
I can let's fix climate change.
Yeah.
Clean air, clean water, clean land.
Yeah.
Let's and we could fix the food stamp problem too.
Tomorrow.
Raise the minimum wage.
Yeah.
Section 8 housing for anybody that needs it.
Mm-hmm.
And universal pre-K.
Yeah.
One of the reasons that all of those women that they easily find in New York City can't go to work is they have a toddler.
Yes.
And if you you have to have a safe place for your toddler to be, which would bless them
mm-hmm.
to be in Head Start.
Well, then you'd have to start paying teacher stuff. So,
you'd have to start paying for it.
Yeah, you have to start paying for all the stuff that you want.
But and jobs training program.
Yeah.
And then jobs programs.
Yes.
And you set all of that up
mm-hmm.
and you say, look, and I am perfectly willing to put my arm around a Republican who wants to talk about the dignity of work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Got it. Dignity of work. It helps people feel better about themselves, like you said, mm-hmm. having that part-time job. Knowing that you can get up in the morning and go meet with somebody and make their life better and help them out.
Yes.
Makes a huge difference in your psyche and the way you approach the world in getting up the next morning.
Absolutely.
It's a fantastic thing to have that for yourself.
But that's not
universally. And so we can have that agreement. I'm happy to agree with any conservative that wants to talk about that and that we are, depriving people of the dignity of work. But we are depriving people of the dignity of work because there's a 20% unemployment rate in the non-white population of this country.
Right.
And we're not doing anything about that. You guys have passed how many abortion bills?
Yeah. How many defunding Obamacare?
And how many jobs bills?
Yeah.
Zero.
Yeah. Well, that's a moral question. You being out of work is because you are a moral failure.
Mm-hmm.
Not because there's no jobs, not because you're not trained.
Well, not because they're in a recession. Right.
Yeah, which
they
keep trying to make worse at every possible turn. Yeah. But yet again, we find ourselves, even with the reformists, even with the outcasts on the right, they can't exist without liberals.
That's it. If the Democratic Party dissolved tomorrow,
yeah.
Rush Limbaugh would have nothing to talk about.
Oh, no, he would. Oh, see, this is the difference. He would continue to invent liberals.
He'd have to invent them.
and the thing is, and that's the problem, the liberals that conservatives are frightened of are fictional. And so they'd go right on being fictional liberals to keep conservatives terrified of everything.
Yeah.
And back when it was the Iraq War, David Brooks, had a perpetual hard-on for Norman Lear, Ed Asner, and Noam Chomsky. And he just kept pounding away on those crazy liberals and their crazy idea that you can suck up to Saddam Hussein and everything will be fine. And that was his vision of what liberals were. It was a lie. Those people are, in fact, all liberals, by the way. But that is not the totality of liberal thinking in the world. But those they will always invent the 1984 reference, the Emmanuel Goldstein they need to mm-hmm. keep their movement coherent. And that's what Andrew Sullivan and Joe Scarborough and Michael Steele cannot, or frankly will not, because it's economically disadvantageous for them to acknowledge this, that their party line right now is a straight ripoff of liberal critiquing. And they never mention liberals. They except a sneer at us. They never mention liberals. So on the right, you have this problem because you can't have a movement without an enemy. And the crazier reality keeps punishing conservative bad ideas,
mm-hmm.
the more you need a bigger enemy to explain why it wasn't your fault.
Yep.
So the more climate change becomes a disaster, the more the economy fails, the more unemployed people we have, the sicker people get, the more we owe money, the stupider things we do, the more stupid and dangerous and uninhabitable our country gets, the more they need their liberal villain to be bigger and bigger and bigger to justify continuing to be conservatives. And you'll never break that dynamic. You'll never get a conservative to say, liberals were right all along.
But you'll also never get a conservative to name one of the people on the other side, whether they're in Congress or not.
They don't have to. They don't have to. Because
that's the point. No one will ask them, name one.
David Gregory's job is to make sure that question never gets asked.
Yeah.
And if it does get asked,
we're out of time.
Speaking of public screw-ups.
We got to move on a little bit. Yeah, we got to move on.
You want to talk about IT disasters or no?
We talked about that last week, and I did want to thank people that wrote to us about that. Thank you. Let's talk about atheism because we got a lot of pushback on that.
I want to squeeze in one. I will not bore people with long IT stories, but I do want to.
Okay, good.
Yeah, because I got a million of them. So we'll just start doing an IT podcast instead of the science fiction podcast. Disastrous IT projects I have known. Clay Johnson, a guy who was on the Chris Hayes show. The Department
of talking about. He is worth talking about.
The Department of Better Government. Bless his heart. That's the name of his organization. The Department of the Department of Better Technology, which we all need, points out, and this is he pulled this out of a group that did an analysis of this, and this really does comport very closely to my experience with large, especially large government IT projects. 90% of all government IT projects over $10 million fail. Mm-hmm. By fail, it's either the stats he quotes either more than half were delayed over budget or didn't meet user expectations, and 41.4% failed completely. Multi-million dollar projects that completely failed. And believe me, I have been through them before, and this is absolutely true, and it is simply baked into the system.
Yeah.
And there are ways to fix it, but as long as telling the boss no or consultants telling the user what you're asking for is crazy and impossible and you can't have it is a disqualifier for getting and keeping the job, and as long as government money is infinite, and as long as nobody ever gets fired who made the initial stupid decision to go with the suck-up who didn't know what the fuck they were talking about over the person who actually told the truth, as long as that person never gets fired, this dynamic will continue to piss away billions of dollars at federal, state, and local level every year. Mm-hmm. End of sermon. Let's go on to atheism, shall we?
Yeah. We got some pushback, and I wanted to bring it up about the letter that we read on militant atheism is the word I'm looking
yes.
for.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the letter from Andrew last week talked about militant atheism. And we got two letters this week about that. We got several letters about it, but two that I wanted to bring up. First of all, I want to talk about Penn Jillette on Lawrence O'Donnell talking with the priest and how they had a friendly debate.
They did.
On atheism versus belief. And Penn Jillette said, you know, every time I come across a Christian, they are like this guy. They are kind and friendly and reasonable and loving, and it's boring how nice they are.
I expect them to get angry and push back and get really mean and defensive, and they never do.
They never do.
You know, we can introduce you to those people if you really want to meet them, but by and large, you know, the Christians we know are that sort of people, are those sort of people.
Yeah.
And
there are assholes on both sides.
Sure. Well, and he said, the reason I'm an atheist is because of people like you.
Yeah.
Because you made it so hospitable for me to think for myself.
On my own, yes.
That I came to this different conclusion. And so, you know, there you go.
But we got a letter from a blogger, fellow blogger, who blogs at skepticallyleft.com.
Uh-huh.
And he wrote, while I vehemently disagree with Andrew's premise, I don't object to any point the two of you raised. So I certainly don't mean this to be a criticism of the episode or its content. Rather, I would take issue to the language Andrew used to describe atheists, particularly vocal militant atheists. Militant is a term many of us, vocal or not, find objectionable. Placing that qualifier before any other creed conjures specific images.
Mm-hmm.
Militant Christians bomb abortion clinics. Militant Muslims detonate bombs, etc. Who Andrew and others describe as militant atheists merely ask difficult questions many people find uncomfortable. Yes, they are irreverent. Sometimes they are even angry, but they don't join terrorist cells. They've never advocated a campaign of violence or eradication of people with whom they differ philosophically. Calling them militant implies atheists take a much harder line than they actually do. And whether it is intentional or not, such qualification categorizes vocal proponents of atheism alongside some of society's most violent psychopathic thugs. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't think you or Andrew, for that matter, meant any harm by it. And I certainly hold you no ill will. Your show has only grown better with time, and I hope to hear much, much more of you in the future. I think that's a good cop. I really do.
Yeah.
And then we had an email exchange with Ross, and I don't exactly remember the way Ross put it, but Ross did say something about either imaginary God in the sky or some sort of fairy tale. I can't exactly remember, but it was alluding to a comment that atheists don't believe in a mythological deity.
Yeah.
And then he wrote us again and he said, guys, I was a little harsher than intended in my previous email to you about your beliefs.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry. I can tell that you get peace from your church and Bible passages, and I respect that. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm just edgy because of goofballs like my Rick Perry and Louis Gohmert.
Yeah, well.
Guys from Texas, and we get that.
Yeah, boy, do we.
But there's no excuse to make direct comments about someone's personal faith. And I wanted to read both of those letters because they cover both sides of the same coin, which is it is entirely possible to learn from one another, to be reasonable, to be supportive of each other, and not get nasty.
Yeah.
And we can join together, believers and atheists alike, or people, I don't know how you want to call it, Christians, people of faith, people who have some sort of, I don't want to be overly positive about my own perspective here, but atheists and non-atheists alike, let's put it that way.
Yeah. Atheists and theists, how's that?
There you go. Atheists and theists can both be equally edgy about Louis Gohmert.
Yes, and should be.
And work for the poor.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about the Pope last week, and this week he had a little kid up next to him hugging him, and, you know, it was beautiful. And he's
sitting in his big chair.
Optics, yeah.
Sitting in his big Pope chair.
My goodness, my mouth just dropped open when I saw that. But, you know, there is a change going on because of this Pope in the focus of the church toward poor people. Can we talk for a minute, too, about the governor of Ohio?
Oh, yeah. We talked about him a little last week, too.
Governor Kasich talking about the war on the poor and how he's going to take the Medicaid money because people need health insurance in his state. And I'm thinking that he simply knows which way the wind blows in Ohio.
Yeah.
And how much people are fed up with him on all kinds of other issues. But I thought it was a positive thing. And I'm wondering what you think of a Republican governor going along this way.
I have voted for Republican governors in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is much to be said for the pure opportunistic politician who will, in fact, rip you off, but will, in fact, also feed people, build schools, and get the roads paved because he knows that his future paycheck depends on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those people are amoral. Probably immoral. There's a certain kind of person who just is drawn to and thrives in the political world that's that way.
Yeah.
And not that all politicians are that way. Not that public servants are even generally that way. Public servants I have met and worked with have been nice, helpful, often genteel, also lazy, libertarian nutbags. They've run the entire spectrum of humanity. So you can't really classify them with a broad brush. But in political life, there's something about the elected office, the elected portion of that draws people who are chameleons and seducers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if we as voters arrange the incentive structure in such a way that we will reward you by feeding poor people,
then they
will feed poor people because they would like your adulation. They'd like to be able to stand up and give speeches. They'd like to have monuments made to them. They'd like for their kids to grow up to be Senator Corleone.
I think also they can make speeches about being a nice guy.
Yes.
And I care about the citizenry of my state.
Yeah.
While at the same time firmly sucking up to the hospital lobby.
Sure.
And, you know, it becomes I'm really worried about some of these Republican governors and what they're going to do when the bill comes due from allowing poor people to choose emergency room care over. They have made the choice. These governors have made the choice of emergency room care for poor people over Medicaid.
Yeah.
Which is so much more expensive in terms of money and health outcomes. And when you start to see in the news media that the bill has come due, because my understanding is that the Affordable Care Act turns off, maybe not right away. I've tried to look this up and I haven't been able to find it. But under Reagan, the healthcare plan was emergency rooms cannot turn away anyone. And the federal government will reimburse states and hospitals for some of their indigent care. It also just increases the prices of everything for healthcare to use emergency room care for poor people.
Mm-hmm.
But I do believe that and maybe somebody can write us and correct me on this, that the Affordable Care Act turns off that spigot because you're going to put your poor people on Medicaid. And so they won't be using emergency rooms for their hospitalization. Well, if you, as a governor, have decided not to take the Medicaid expansion, then where's that money going to come from? And all of these Republican governors have balanced budget amendments in their states.
They're kind
of
stuck.
It's got to come from someplace. Now, they can cut more of other poor people's services, but at some point, someone's going to notice that you're giving Cadillac care in emergency rooms and clogging up emergency rooms with poor people who don't have health insurance, rather than taking the money from the federal government to just get them out of there and get them into the city health clinic, the Sanders Center, as we call it, named after Bernie Sanders. So I'm going to be really interested in the next couple of years as to how that works out, because I think the reason that Jan Brewer went so hard for the Medicaid expansion was she knew a lot of hospital guys. And Kasich the same way. I mean, I don't think he is unaware that hospital lobbying groups exist in his state and that they want to make sure that their bottom line isn't affected by this.
Eventually, reality forces politicians to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
They may do it in a, or it forces them to do something.
It forced Texas to sneakily try to take the money. I don't know how that worked out either. I should look that up too. They were trying to take the Medicaid money for disabled children, for mentally disabled children in particular, and not take the rest of it because there was no money for that in their budget. And they had these mentally disabled people who were going to be the state's problem no matter what. So
and it has to be
that money. Yeah.
And whatever they do has to be able to be calibrated.
Yeah.
To their political advantage. So I was actually just trying to look up a Churchill quote. I can't quite remember it, so I can't quite search it. But it's something about explaining what a political number is, what political math is. Mm-hmm. You know, a political number is not you as prime minister have, I don't know, immunized more children or given more children milk. X number of people that a political number is you have given more milk or immunized more children than any other prime minister in history. That's a political number. And so whatever reality forces them to do, it has to comport with their basic need to get reelected. Mm-hmm. And so however many disasters befall this country, conservatives will generally say what we need is less regulation and lower taxes. No matter what, it doesn't matter that that's insane. That is exactly the opposite of truth, because that is what their constituents want to hear. And as lower regulation and lower taxes makes things worse, they just come back around and double down. We'll see. We need even lower regulation and even fewer taxes until something deep in the bones breaks. And then they can't tell that lie anymore. Then it'll be another lie. Then it'll be time to round up all the dissenters. You know, all the backstabbers, all the secret conspirators, or whatever the fuck it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that Kasich is trying to figure out a way to get right with his voters in such a way that he retains his political viability.
Yeah.
And a good politician will figure out a way to do that. It might not be in a way you like. There, you know, we talked before about it was either Huey Long or someone else who built hospitals for poor black people.
Yep. To keep them out of the white hospital.
By promising the white folks, I'll keep those blacks out of your area, out of your hospital.
Yeah.
So you might not like it. Harry Truman had to play ball with boss Prendergast and put his corrupt friends on the payroll in order to get X number of miles of roads paved, which is what he was supposed to do. And it galled him that he had to play ball with this patently corrupt person, but that was the price he had to pay to get his stuff done.
I did find the thing this right along those lines. The article, it's an article in Think Progress from August about how Rick Perry was asking for $100 million, not $100 billion, which he could get to expand Texas Medicaid, but $100 million for the Texas Community First Choice Program, which provides community-based medical services to disabled and elderly Texans. It's a very popular program. It's administered through Medicaid, and it allows older Americans and those that are disabled to stay in their homes rather than go to a facility.
Yeah.
And it's a very popular Texas-based program. So Rick Perry was saying, well, this is because this is some innovation that we did in Texas, and we would love to have more funding for it.
Sure.
This isn't Obamacare. This is us asking for funding for our Texas program. Now, here's the part that to me was very interesting, right along the lines that you were saying. Advocates for the poor and disabled who support expanding this program under Obamacare were apprehensive to even talk about the program's relation to the health law out of fear that Texas officials would back out of their funding bid. Mm-hmm. Because if you call them on it and say, oh, you're going to take part of this Obamacare money, then they'll say, no, we're not. And there goes the funding for the disabled and elderly staying in their homes.
Yep. Yep.
They want that money because yes. they want to help these people.
Well, this is why, you know, Truman called the Truman Plan the Marshall Plan.
Yeah, right.
Because they wouldn't accept it if it was the Truman Plan. This is why Republican governors and mayors all over this country made a great big show of standing up with giant novelty checks with their names on it, spending that Obama stimulus money, which they didn't call Obama stimulus money. Yeah. It is not a surprise to anybody who's older than 8 years old or has ever been through a student council election that a minimally competent politician will find a way to turn what he should or should not do or his ideology tells him he should or should not want into an advantage. Just as long as he can reframe it, it's almost always a guy, not always, but almost always, just as long as he can reframe it in such a way that makes his constituents happy.
Yeah.
And that's why, getting back to the Chris Hayes show, just for a second, both sides.
Yeah.
You can't say, if you're a Republican,
digestible.
Yes, you can't tell conservatives who elect you. I'm not saying that this is a good thing. I'm saying it's a fact of political life. You cannot tell conservatives who elect you that they're the problem. You cannot tell the audience for Meet the Press, as much as I might want them to, half of you people out there are fucking crazy.
Yeah.
You're the problem.
That's why the smart thing for the Republican governors to do is say, to hell with Obamacare and that Kathleen Sebelius.
We'll do
Texas
it our way.
Texas is going to set up our own program.
Yeehaw!
In Kentucky.
Yeah.
And that Which the is... Democratic governor of Kentucky was damn smart. He said, we set up our own plan. It's better than Obamacare.
Yeah.
Everybody signed up. Mm-hmm. So makes well, there, sense. Makes there, sense.
I'll steal a couple of two things from the West Wing. and one is Bruno.
Everybody take a drink. Go
everybody take
that.
A couple of drinks. One is like Bruno talking about P.T. Barnum selling white salmon, which is grotesque to look at, I believe. But he like put a sign over it saying, guaranteed not to turn red.
Well, you know, that's how they were able to serve sauerkraut on sailing ships. The British were feeding canned sauerkraut to their crew.
Yeah.
And people refused to eat it on the boat because it's pickled cabbage.
Right.
You know? That's we're asking me to eat pickled cabbage. And so the one very smart captain of these sailing vessels said, no, oh my gosh, this is only for the captain's table.
Yeah. What?
why are you serving this to them? This is a delicacy. And all of a sudden it was okay. Well, if we run out of things, I guess we have to give it to the crew.
I suppose so. You know, it's whitewashing the fence. It's Huckleberry Finn.
Yeah.
I'm Sawyer, whitewashing the fence. As long as it looks like something that you're going to be kept from doing by the government, you'll want it. And you can make people want to whitewash that fence with you. And it's very smart. It's politically smart. A lot of what Obama does by removing himself from the equation is smart politics, given the fact half the country is crazy.
Yeah.
And yet they're poor. They need health care. And you're sort of stuck with, you know, as much as my liberal base, that's me, might want them to secede and just get the hell out of the way. We're stuck with them. So how do we best navigate that very ugly political reality? The other West Wing point was, I think it was Sam arguing with the like head of the major Latino union about the upcoming election. And they started going back and forth and back and forth. They started speaking Spanish back and forth. And they were arguing about, you know, this guy's holding me hostage and I don't want to do it. And the guy finally demands amnesty. And Sam says, absolutely not. And the person who's with him says, I'm sure we can work with that. And Sam is really pissed and looks at this guy. And this is, mind you, this is a fictional Democratic backer.
Fantasy
this
story,
is
a, yeah.
This is it. But the guy involved is, you know, is pretty close to sort of how real politics works. He's a Democrat. He's a guy who works for Daley in the trenches. You know, he knows his stuff. He knows he can deliver 300,000 votes or 1 million votes or 2 million votes. And Sam asks him, what about loyalty? And the guy just rolls his eyes at him. Loyalty. You can't put loyalty in the bank. What do I get?
Mm-hmm.
You know, politics is about paying people off.
Yeah.
it's secondarily about helping people who need help. If you can combine those two, that's progressive government. Getting people, paying people, paying teachers. I'm not talking about bribing teachers. I'm talking about paying people like teachers as competent professionals, not treating them like dogs.
But see, I think that's where we are in such a bad place politically, uh-huh. which is the one thing that the Republican Party wants over and over again is to save face. And they've moved so far away from any position where they can save face by being yes. so wrong and so awful yeah. so many times for so many years that, you know, the Democrats in the House have just had it.
Yes, which I'm delighted to see.
I mean, I am delighted to see that, too.
At some point in the relationship, in yeah. the bad, in the, as a relationship goes bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
You reach that place where, you know, this has happened to me.
Yes.
You sort of you lean across.
Not with me, darling.
Not with you. Not with you, no. babe. You and I are.
We're golden.
Aces. We're aces.
Good. I love it.
When you lean across what is an incredibly large abyss that's about to become uncrossable, tell the other person what you're about to do, you will never be able to take back. I will never be able to forgive. You are about to burn the last bridge between us. Make sure you intend to do that, because mm-hmm. once you've done it, you can't go back.
Right.
That's the land where we're conservatives live now.
Yeah.
They spent, and the problem is they don't remember it.
No, because they erase their own history. The Etch-a-Sketch keeps getting shaken by them.
This is why I used to call strategic forgettery.
Yeah.
It's they literally don't remember the positions they took a month or 2 months or 4 months or 8 months or 10 months.
Where they burned the bridges. Yes.
Where they impeached Bill Clinton. Where they, you know, they let the Iran-Contra traitors go and then turn around and impeach the next guy. Where they marched us into the wrong war. Where they botched, where they tortured, where they did all these terrible things.
Where they created the deficit.
Yes. Where they ran on getting rid of the surplus.
Getting rid of the surplus. Yes.
They ran because surpluses are bad. So they literally have no memory of that at all. They have trained themselves not to remember any of that stuff. So they are completely uncomprehending as to why Democrats are so mad at them. And you can't argue with people who have no short-term memory because they just don't remember anything that they've done. But getting full and fed up with them and really just saying, that's it, we've had it, we're done. We're done here is a delightful turn of events. And I'm glad to see it. But ultimately, this is why conservatism and republicanism is doomed.
Yeah.
Because they have gone to a place.
I think that's what Chris Hayes was trying to ask that congressman, mm-hmm. which is what happens when your party destroys immigration reform? What happens to your party? What happens when this marriage is really over?
And you and I both know the answer to that question. There will be a 2 week period of tense crisis where the world economy is on the brink, or immigration is on the brink, or something disastrous is on some brink somewhere. And Republicans are trying really hard to push it in. And at the last minute, somebody will stop them from doing that. Everyone will draw their collective breath, and we'll go back to talking about how awful both sides are.
Both sides are.
Because that's how our dynamic works. Speaking of both sides, may I bring up two last things really quick?
Yes.
I was upbraided. Remember that Glenn Greenwald thing?
Yeah, I didn't want you to forget about giving credit where credit was due to Glenn Greenwald.
I made a modestly complimentary factual statement about a good thing that Glenn Greenwald did. And that sort of is chock-a-block with the many, many columns I've written, taking him to task for specific factual and, I would argue, rhetorical disasters, mistakes, overreaches, lies in some occasions that I'm mad at because they actively detract from his credibility and destroy his story. That's what pisses me off about it. But I said this modestly complimentary thing about it, immediately got a comment and an email that was going to be my last email from this reader, who told me that he or she is sick and tired of me having my head up Glenn Greenwald's rear end.
Glenn Greenwald's ass. How dare you?
And pasted in this entire long, long, long article about how the Koch brothers this and the Koch brothers that and libertarian funding, all of which I know already.
And 9/11 was a hoax?
No. I'm not going to mock them for that. But it was, you know, you could just send me the link. But this mile-long article about how libertarians and Kochs and blah, 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 which I've written about, I don't know, maybe 700 times, and objectivism and randlandism, which I've written about maybe 300 times, but that even saying anything that's simply true, I'm glad Glenn Greenwald took advantage of his opportunity mm-hmm. to talk to Bill Keller he took advantage of that opportunity to
about
drop
his employee
to drop yeah. him like you know, to whack him over David Brooks. I'm glad he did that. Yeah. And that instantly earned me the opprobrium of one of my
your head is up Glenn Greenwald's butt.
And speaking of up their butts, I last want to mention that Rand Paul, in the space of 1 week, has managed to disqualify himself
yes.
from the premier young adult Atlas Shrugged essay writing contest. Because
which goes on and on and on and on about plagiarism disqualifying yes. you from the contest.
And,
yes.
And I don't think Rand Paul understands what the word I literally do not believe, and I've said that a lot. I think he does not understand what the word plagiarism means at all. Yep. Which for a person whose entire philosophy is objecting to mooching and stealing yeah. other people's work is yeah. fucking hilarious. It's a perfect EOKR moment.
It is.
And I have worked with people who were confirmed Randite libertarians who live off the government teat and mm-hmm. only advance in their career by sucking up to people who are every bit as incompetent as they are. And they go home at night and pour themselves a drink and bitch about those leeches who leech off the government. And their brains are wired in such a way they cannot see that they themselves are the biggest parody of everything they hate. And congratulations, Rand Paul, you've done it.
Well, and if he had said, look, in my prepared notes.
Yes.
These Wikipedia articles were in quotation marks. I have a footnote on them that it says it's from Wikipedia. I didn't read the footnote
done.
In my speech, and I'm really sorry. From now on, I'll do that.
And you know what?
We're done.
I'm a creature of the internet. I'm very social media oriented. If this had been a blog post, I would have linked it to Wikipedia. I just forgot to do it. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But to just look the camera straight in the eye and pretend you don't know what theft of intellectual property is.
Yeah, yeah.
As a Randite, as a guy who calls himself Rand Paul, a guy who preaches objectivism, the guy who carries around copies of The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged and who blah, 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 and Rand this and that, looks in the camera and says, I don't know what you mean, steal from somebody. I have no idea what that means. Was just so fucking rare, so perfect. I wanted to sort of celebrate that moment before it swept down the and I won't even talk about Suzanne Summers. How's that?
Thigh Master.
Yeah.
And she's got a thick skin.
She does. And a column in the Wall Street Journal, which is very exciting. So
that's more than either one of us have.
Or ever will. So congratulations, Suzanne Summers.
But you know what we do have, Driftglass?
We have each other.
Besides each other.
We have internet kitties.
We have an internet kitty every week.
We do.
And every week we post them to our Facebook page and website. An internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitties, plural, come from our friend John, and they are the Fire Team kitties. There are at least four of them.
Fire Team.
And they're the Fire Team. They like to sleep inside the camouflage duffel bag. Uh-huh. That way they're ready to go.
Yeah. Like the fire.
They're very adorable, uh-huh. as kittens can be. You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. We love hearing from you. If you have sent science fiction questions that have not been asked yet, I've had kind of a hiccup in my Gmail, so I would appreciate if you would send them again to mrs.driftglass@gmail.com. Feel free to send them again, because something has happened to that account. I'm not quite sure what. And again, feel free to write to us anywhere you want, and be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service Go Postal Unions letter on the air unless you say otherwise.
And as you are listening to this, we are probably on our way to Chicago at the moment.
Yes, we're going to be in Chicago for one night only.
One night only. So
I don't want to meet with anybody. We're going to be in a hotel by ourselves with no kids.
Yes.
Sorry. Over the summer.
Sorry.
By the way, also write us and let us know, do you guys think we should go to Netroots Nation? And are you planning to go? It is in Detroit. I believe it's in July mm-hmm. of next year. It's possible that there will be candidates there. I'm not sure. At this point, that's 2014. So it's possible there will be some candidates for president there.
The budget I had for doing anything like this in 2007 when I went to McCormick Place is gone.
Right.
So...
We would have to do a fundraiser.
We would have to do a fairly substantial fundraiser.
You know what we got to do? We got to hire an entourage.
Obviously.
With our fundraiser money.
That would take even more fundraiser money. Although I have a feeling finding unemployed people in Detroit to become our entourage will not be that hard.
Unless they're working for J.P. Morgan Chase.
That's right. Because,
by that time, we all will be. Hey, Driftglass, how are the internet kitties doing this week?
Well, Blue Gal, the internet kitties are pretty smug because they always believe the Obamacare portal should have been done in COBOL.
Let's think about living. Just think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-dovey. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional F Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2013, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.